All right, welcome to the Federalist Society Corporation's Practice Group program on the role of the SEC in the financial services crisis. I'm Stephen Bainbridge, and I'll be moderating the panel today. Back in September, when the presidential campaign and the financial services crisis were both roiling the waters, Senator John McCain remarked that if he were president at that moment, he would fire SEC Chairman Chris Cox. This set off a frenzy in the media and the blogosphere, which oddly focused on the question of whether the president, in fact, can fire the chairman of the SEC. An interesting administrative law question, to be sure, but it obscured the more fundamental issue of whether, in fact, the SEC bore any responsibility for the financial services crisis. Let's tick off some of the bullet points that critics of the SEC have raised. They allege failure adequately to police holding companies and unregulated affiliates of broker-dealers. The 2004 amendments to the net capital rule allowing the big five investment banks to become significantly more leveraged. The failure of the voluntary supervision program for the big five investment. Facilitating speculation by repealing the uptick rule and failing adequately to police naked short selling. Antiquated disclosure rules that have failed to keep up with financial innovation. And failing timely to address the question of how mark-to-market and mark-to-model accounting would work during a serious financial downturn. In response, the SEC's defenders point to such actions as enhanced enforcement of the rules against naked short selling, at least recently, a ban on short selling of financial institution stock, providing accounting guidance on the use of mark-to-market rules, multiple enforcement proceedings, including proceedings involving market manipulation, a memorandum of understanding with the Federal Reserve Board to promote better information sharing. And they also argue that Congress failed to give the SEC either the enforcement budget that it needed and, in many cases, such as credit default swaps and so on, they failed to give the SEC jurisdiction over the problems at hand. Now, with time having passed and the waters having smoothed a bit and the presidential campaign behind us, we think we can now look back and examine two fundamental questions. First, does the SEC in fact bear any significant responsibility for the financial services crisis of 2008? Were there in fact errors made at the regulatory agency that either that in some way contributed to either the coming of the financial crisis or its depth? Second, going forward, what regulatory actions should the new Congress and newly elected President Obama take with respect to the SEC? We have heard many calls for financial services reform, a so-called New Deal, and this raises the question of what the SEC, a creature of the original New Deal, will look like this time next year. As you know, this 2010 will be the 75th anniversary, or 2009 rather, will be the 75th anniversary of the SEC. Presumably, the SEC will be around to celebrate that birthday, but will it look, or will it be preparing to look, quite different than it does today? We have a very distinguished panel to address these issues. Paul Atkins was SEC Commissioner from 2002 to 2008, and during his tenure, he emphasized the need for regulation that considers costs and benefits and that fosters competitiveness of U.S. capital markets. Prior to joining the commission, Mr. Atkins was a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers. Ed Kitch is the Mary and Daniel Loughran Professor of Law at the University of Virginia, my alma mater. His scholarly and teaching interests include corporation law, securities regulation, industrial and intellectual property, economic regulation, and legal and economic history. George Terwilliger is a senior partner in the Washington, D.C. firm of White & Case, and served as a presidential appointee in two administrations, first as the U.S. Attorney for the District of Vermont under the Reagan administration, and then served as Deputy Attorney General and actually as Acting Attorney General under Bush the 41st. John Macy is the Sam Harris Professor of Law, Corporate Law, Corporate Finance, and Securities Law at Yale University, is the prolific author of numerous books and articles on insider trading, corporate finance, corporate and securities law, and banking law. He serves on FINRA's National Adjudicatory Council and on FINRA's Council of Economic Advisors. Each of the panelists will make a brief opening statement, after which we'll see if we can get a debate going amongst the panelists, and then we'll open the proceedings to questions from the floor. Commissioner Atkins.
Well, thank you very much, Steve, and good morning to all of you. It's a great pleasure to be here, and as a former federal official, I'm happy to say I don't have to give any disclaimers. So everything I say now is, attributable to me, which is a great liberating feeling. And also, I guess I can say I probably had a pretty good market timing because my last day in office was August 1, right before some of the things started to pop. So anyway, I'm probably one of the few who can say I'm happily unemployed right now in the country trying to get my life back in order. But anyway, this is a very important topic, and I'm glad that you all are here today and look forward to the discussion. And I think, in light of this month's election and outcome, and I guess it's still not necessarily finished yet since there are still two seats in the Senate that need to be determined, and those are going to be very important seats, of course, as have discussed at this conference so far. It's very important to get the lessons correct, the takeaways from the current crisis, which, of course, is still unfolding. But I think it's safe to say that the current situation is not the result of any so-called Bush deregulatory philosophy, as was bandied about in the campaign by the president-elect and others. I'm hoping that was electioneering rather than any great analysis. Because when you look at the current crisis, it is global in nature. The most heavily regulated entities were the ones that suffered versus, at least so far, the lightest regulated entities. When you look at European banks and their leverage, for example, compared to American banks, if you look, there was a Bank for International Settlement study that showed leverage in banks in the U.S. and in Europe starting in 2001 and going through 2008. The U.S. banks, commercial banks, were pretty steady at about 15-1 ratio. The U.S. investment banks in 2001 had about a 20-1 leverage ratio, and it went up to about 30-1 in 2008. When we look at European banks, theirs started at about 30-1 back in 2001 and rose to between 40-50-1 here recently. So on those sorts of measurements, at least, the U.S. was not, off on one side of the distribution. And then I think we have to look at state-run banks in Germany and elsewhere who had some very faulty risk management and investment strategies. Looking at the credit rating agencies, which of course have had a checkered period of oversight. So with all that, hopefully we will get down to the bottom of it in next year and start to analyze where we have been and where we are going. Steve alluded to the 1930s. If you look at our current situation, here in the 21st century, we still have not necessarily dug ourselves out of the mistakes that were made policy-wise back in the 1930s. And so I'm sure there are going to be investigations next year by Congress, and there's sort of an eerie similarity between these days, of course, and the 1930s. And you just have to go back to the Senate banking hearings of 1932 and 1933 were the famous PCORA hearings, which led to the passage of many of the laws that make up our securities regulatory construct these days. But those hearings led directly to the passage of course, the Securities Act of 33, the Exchange Act of 34, the Public Utility Holding Company Act of 35, the Trust Indenture Act of 39, the Investment Advisors Act of 1940, and the Investment Company Act of 1940 also. So are we in for another sort of legislative avalanche like that? I imagine we are. There have to be things to clean up some of the gaps in regulation and elsewhere that have been shown. But I think we have to pay attention to, again, what are the proper lessons. If you look back in the 1930s, there, one of the key acts, which we don't really think about anymore because it was repealed, actually on my in 2006, was the Public Utility Holding Company Act of 1935, which completely remade the electric and gas transmission and electric generation industry in the United States. And that was the SEC's main job, believe it or not, for about 30 years, was to break apart the interstate utility industry and to make it into essentially what was a balkanized system of utilities. And so that, of course, has effects to today as far as investment in that industry, and the act was finally repealed, like I said, just 2 years ago. So you can hear people proclaiming the death of capitalism, that deregulation during the past 8 years led to this market collapse. I'm sure all of us in this room would agree that you could hardly call the last 8 years deregulatory when you look at Sarbanes-Oxley, the new SRO rules that came out from FINRA and New York Stock Exchange and NASD, new FASB rules, new SEC rules regarding compliance and trading. They were extremely expensive, of course, and people had to pay attention to them and adapt their businesses to them. So you could hardly call any of that deregulatory. And then I didn't necessarily agree with all of these rules or when they came out, but it turns out that I think that many of them were not aimed at the correct risk points of the system. I mean, I think that's the inherent problem with regulation. It's a blunt instrument at best, and it's subject to the frailties of human regulators. So if the regulator does not use an effective cost-benefit system to analyze its proposed rules properly, or doesn't listen to public comments, or tries to regulate through enforcement, like, for example, the research analyst case that was brought by Elliot Spitzer and the SEC and others, the consequences can be inconsistent, distortive, and not easily corrected in the long run. You know, I look forward to discussing more of this, but I think when you look at what's happened over the last few years with respect to regulation, I would posit that the SEC was distracted by just this sort of ad hocery as far as regulation goes, and I'd point to the period of 2003 to 2005 with our regulation NMS, the hedge fund registration rule, which of course was thrown out by the courts as being basically the SEC's being ultra vires, and then the mutual fund independent chairman rule. Those distracted the staff and the commission and the industry right at a very crucial time, 03 to 05, when if you look at charts of CDOs and CDSs, it's like a hockey stick, basically, the way they took off. And unfortunately, people were not paying attention to essential risk management aspects of this, and that is back office operations, documentation, and unfortunately, we didn't allow for exchange trading or push for exchange trading of some of these, and we can talk about some of the reasons for that. But with that, let me pass it on to my fellow panelists and look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Kitch.
Thank you, Steve, and thanks to the Federalist Society for bringing this group together at this timely moment. I'm prepared to take the position SEC no, and I'll intervene to defend it at any point in the discussion. I'm willing to stipulate that there's more than one member of the United States Senate who believes that the function of the SEC is to ensure that stock markets always rise in a gradual and even fashion, thus providing a high-return, low-risk form of investment. I've never understood how this financial alchemy is to be achieved, nor do I think it is a mission assigned to the SEC by relevant statutes. But if the SEC is not responsible, there is the question of what is or what is happening. I want to comment first on the timing of these events. In the discussion, there's always much comparison to the Depression. There is one striking difference here. The stock market crash of 1929 occurred well before the presidential election and President Roosevelt's taking office. This crisis has been coterminous with the transition, the election, and the transition of power. And I think that makes a difference because it makes the interpretation of the events much more difficult. And I'd like to offer two basic interpretations, which I think will be in play in historical investigation in years to come and are in play right now in policy discussions. The first interpretation is that this decline in markets is understood as the public proof and coming in to full view of a long series of policy mistakes by the Bush administration. The chickens, so to say, are coming home to roost. The other interpretation is that markets are forward-looking and that these market actions our response to predictions about future policy changes that are expected or likely to be implemented as a result of the outcome of the election. Which it is has a lot of importance for how one thinks, what one thinks the appropriate legislative and policy response is. The first interpretation leads to the conclusion that this is simply a vivid proof of the need for significant and dramatic policy changes, regulatory changes, new statutes, and new intervention by the government. And indeed, may even be a kind of a strong circularity in this. If the forward-looking response is, if the forward-looking interpretation is correct, then there could be a vicious circularity because as the market falls, it would simply increase the likelihood that the feared changes would take place. Now, it's very important to have some view on the question of what actually is happening in the markets. My interpretation is that all of the principal players, and as Paul said, this is a global phenomenon, not a U.S. phenomenon, all of the principal players are in basically a deleveraging panic. They all, at about the same time, revised their estimates, first of their liquidity needs, and second, of the liquidity properties of the financial assets which they held. This set off a massive effort to restructure portfolios, which involved selling some classes of assets, and buying other classes, most dramatically and notably treasury instruments. This appears to be the Federal Reserve diagnosis, which under the leadership of Ben Bernanke, who has internalized Milton Friedman's more than 30 years of teaching and proselytizing on this question, has viewed this to be the cause and has responded with a very strong policy response. Milton has always said that the problem in these situations is that the central banks are too cowardly. This central bank is not being cowardly. In the last 8 weeks, the Federal Reserve has doubled its size of its balance sheet. It is increasing high-powered money in the last 4 weeks at an annual rate in excess of 300%, and it appears to be firmly set on this course. This creates a very dramatic hockey stick in the monetary statistics of a really historically unprecedented sort, and is going to provide a real on-the-ground demonstration of whether or not Milton's teachings were correct. Now, what's the cause? It's clear that there was a massive global mistake by a wide range of financial actors and institutions, individual citizens and consumers, all of whom made an error in their estimation of their liquidity needs and the appropriate structure of their balance sheets. This was encouraged by government policies. If you take the standard citizen, the government encouraged citizens to mortgage their homes to the hilt, to view their home equity as a bank account accessible through equity lines of credit, and was supportive of generous credit card lines of credit. The financial institutions worldwide did the same thing, and governments worldwide have done the same thing. Everyone cannot deleverage at the same time. Why do these large and massive institutions make these mistakes? Well, as a matter of theory, we know the answer. The usual moniker is agency cost. In this particular crisis, one dramatic illustration is the compensation structure of investment bankers and hedge fund managers who take enormous shares of the upside but have absolutely no liability for or responsibility for the downside. These compensation packages encourage them to increase risk, to grab for their share of the upside, and to simply walk away when the downside occurs, as we see in the case of many hedge funds that are now liquidating and closing up. What to do about it? Well, there's bad news. We don't know what to do about agency costs. And there's good news, which I think probably for at least a couple of decades there's been enough suffering so this problem will not recur. It has a generational aspect. These storms, these financial storms, seem to hit from time to time. But as they fade into the past and the people who have experienced them die, the new generation can never quite believe that they actually occur. And from time to time, the youngsters have to be taught exactly how treacherous and unreliable these markets can be. Finally, there's an elephant in the room, which doesn't seem to be discussed by anyone. And it is that the largest global financial institution in the world is very reliant on short-term borrowing, and it is not subject either to effective regulation or self-control. That institution is the United States government, whose borrowing has gone up from $5 trillion in 2000. It's now above $11 trillion and moving up rapidly. That all depends on daily funding in the Treasury market, and of course, one might take comfort from the fact that Treasury rates are now at historic lows. That is, the government is getting very inexpensive financing. But there's one thing that we have learned from this course of events which should give us pause, and that is these markets will turn on you on a dime. Lehman Brothers, AIG, and others relied on daily overnight funding year after year after year after year without the slightest problem. And that went right up to their collapse until suddenly they were shut out of the markets and they could not fund themselves. Do we need to worry that the same thing can happen in the U.S. Treasury market? And if it does, what should we do to prevent it? Thank you.
Mr. Twillinger.
Thank you, Steve. Professor, your watch? Oh, is that Paul?
Sorry, Paul.
Yeah, that's okay. And now mine. Good morning. It's really an honor for me to join a panel with this kind of credentials and expertise. I was really pleased to be asked to join this discussion because not only do I think is it an interesting question, but I think it's also a really important one. And for those of you who share the view that I do, that there is an element of a regulatory problem to the root causes of some of the problems we've experienced, I think, as usually happens in a crisis, this may be a time of opportunity to speak to some of the issues that matter to us and maybe try to foster correction. And I know that probably sounds very much like wishful thinking given what the political outcome has been, but I really don't think that's the case. And by addressing the questions that were posed to us, I'd like to try to explain briefly why. Just to restate the question for a second, we were asked, does the SEC, in fact, bear any significant responsibility for the financial crisis of 2008? And I suppose, in some sense, every element of the government financial policy and enforcement apparatus bears responsibility because preventing what has happened, and in fact what is still happening, is what they are supposed to do. But I think the most focused area of responsibility here is, if looking at government in particular, is allowing political factors far too much influence in setting economic policy and what, for lack of a better term, I'll call economic enforcement policy. Particularly in setting the regulatory framework that governs aspects of our economic engine. Addressing the full scope of that responsibility and accountability for the decisions which drive economic and regulatory policy is, of course, beyond this discussion, but would be one worth having sometime. But looking more narrowly to the SEC's role, both retrospectively and prospectively, I think, provides a good window to some of the issues and the significant elements of responsibility for what got us here and some notions of how to get out of this trough. I want to start by asking even more pointedly a question that Paul raised, and that is, fundamentally, what is the SEC's role? And I think it's interesting that we even have to ask that question. To my mind, and I think this is clear from the statute, the answer is clearly to promote investor confidence in the market for publicly traded securities. And by that standard, if that's correct, it might be easy to conclude that the SEC has performed very badly and blame it for the stock market's problems and some other economic issues that have arisen. But I think that conclusion would, in fact, be wrong. Investors lack confidence not in the market for publicly traded securities, but in the economy in which that market functions. Now, again, it's beyond this discussion and clearly beyond my expertise to say why that's the case, but it's absolutely clear, I think, that no amount of regulatory policy or enforcement by the SEC could have prevented the erosion of economic confidence that has occurred or perhaps more importantly at the moment at least, can restore that confidence to normal levels. Now, there may be some specific exceptions to this. Abuse of short selling, for example, may in fact be something worth a specific look. But apart from that, and in addition to asking what the SEC's fundamental role is, I think it's time to ask what fundamentally is the role of the federal establishment in regard to commerce and the economic system, and particularly, what is its enforcement role? And here again, I don't think the answer to that question should be difficult. The system that our founders set in motion has as a core purpose promoting commerce for the general benefit of the people. And it stands to reason that its enforcement role should be centered on protecting the means and instrumentalities of commerce from the harm of fraud, dishonesty, outright theft, lack of transparency, and so forth. Chief among the instrumentalities of commerce that the government should be protecting are the financial institutions and firms that create and leverage the capital that's necessary for economic activity and growth. And again, we could easily conclude that the federal establishment has failed of late in that mission because we've witnessed the before our very eyes, the collapse of major financial institutions. Putting perhaps this question another way, did the government fail to protect these institutions from failure, or did it pave the way for failure by a laissez-faire regulatory scheme that permitted these institutions to, in fact, kill themselves by participating in financial overreaching attendant to unprecedented, at least in the United States. And again, I think Paul's point about comparing the leverage in the United States to Europe is a really important one. But did we allow these institutions to so over-leverage themselves that they, in fact, were committing suicide? The answers to all of these, which I think are debatable questions and provoke debatable points, make the discussion interesting, at least as an academic matter. But this isn't an academic matter. The circumstances that have been created is very real to a lot of people, and I really fear over the next 6 months, the next two quarters, is going to get a lot worse. It's vital to our citizens and to the future of our country and, frankly, to the security of our country that we find some answers to these questions. So my own view is that our patchwork quilt of regulations and regulatory agencies is, in fact, concentrated very much on creating and enforcing exacting standards as to what must be done to fell and harvest the trees. But no one is really watching the forest being managed. Rather than regulate and enforce in the first instance with the fundamental objective of protecting the means and instrumentalities of commerce, we engage in political feel-goodism by passing regulations which satisfy a political need. So what does this mean for the SEC on a prospective basis, which was the second question we were at least asked to tee up. And I'm afraid I have what may be viewed, at least in some quarters here, as some heretical views. In concept, and I want to underscore the term concept, I'm forced to agree with Senator Schumer's conclusions, but perhaps not his reasons, and those of others that we need unified financial regulation and enforcement at the federal level. When I served as Deputy Attorney General in the early 1990s, I chaired the Interagency Financial Crime Task Force, which was designed to bring together all the agencies that had a role in financial crime enforcement to deal with the fallout from the savings and loan crisis. It was apparent to me at the time that both policy and enforcement was extremely fragmented among the agencies that were responsible for that at the federal level. And in addition, and perhaps more importantly, perspective on the problems and addressing the problems and dealing with the enforcement issues that those problems arose was very narrowly focused by an agency's jurisdiction and its own peculiar both statutory and policy concerns. But unifying the regulatory structure is not enough. And if that isn't accompanied by a clear course change in both our regulatory and enforcement policy, it could be counterproductive. A unified agency should have as its primary goal the core components of the federal establishment's role in regard to commerce. And these could be built into such an agency's DNA by simply having Congress identify in statute what those are and requiring that every regulation made and enforced by the agency be in harmony with those goals and requiring courts to respect those parameters for the federal role by statute. I think this presents us with a very, very important opportunity to restate what those goals are and, in fact, get them embedded into our law and thereby prevent the sort of political knee-jerk reaction to regulate retrospectively for last year's problem without a view towards managing the forest. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gallinger. Professor Mason.
First, let me say it's a great pleasure to be here. This really is, people always say this, but in this case it actually is true, an extremely distinguished panel. I do want to indulge myself in something I've wanted to do for quite a while, which is to say that single out Paul Atkins. I'm a longtime student of the SEC and a student of the SEC both as an administrative agency and as a bureaucracy. And steal a little bit from Federalist 10, Madison, of course, is right that enlightened statesmen are not always at the helm. Paul Atkins shows us that sometimes they actually are at the helm. Unfortunately, he had to share the tiller with some less enlightened folks, but I really appreciate your work in Washington, and now that you're no longer in the position to subpoena me or anything, I feel as though I can say that. Let me talk. What I'm going to do, consistent with sort of my general approach to the Securities and Exchange Commission, is to first talk a little bit about my perspective, and then make within about a minute each some discrete points about what I think is going to be happening in the future and what is appropriate. So, when I say that I study the SEC as a bureaucracy, what I mean is, as many of you know, to what extent is it subject to capture by its constituents? To what extent is it motivated by concerns about its budget? To what extent are people in the SEC motivated by their own professional career concerns of going to work in law firms or investment banks? And to what extent do those kind of public choice incentives cause maybe the agency to behave in ways that that are inconsistent with the publicly articulated general purpose justifications for the agency? And I'll just make one point about that, which, because of the time, just to say that until today, just as a matter of fact, every time we've had a problem in the markets for which the SEC might justifiably or not be blamed, the ineluctable reality is that this has led to an increase in the SEC's budget. We may all recall when Eliot Spitzer was the Attorney General of the state of New York, he really attacked the SEC vociferously and said that heads should roll at the SEC. A lot of people are, the SEC were incompetent. And the SEC took maybe more than its share of blame for the accounting crises, the market timing and late trading problems, and a variety of other, the price fixing among securities firms and the Odd Eight quote scandal. But despite the tremendous amount of complaints about the SEC's performance, with each crisis, their budget increased dramatically, the Enron era actually brought a doubling in the size of the SEC's budget. Now, what's interesting about this, from the standpoint of the kind of the, what we're supposed to be talking, you know, what's the future for the SEC? For the first time, people seem to be different for three reasons that predate the crisis. One is the SEC has been subject to much greater criticism than ever in its history. Not only Elliot Spitzer, but lots of people have been charging about its incompetence. For the kind of marquee regulatory agency in the United States, this is quite a come down. Similarly, for the first time, and I think this is actually unjustified, the SEC has been charged by other government agencies with corruption, really, of favoring, allowing certain regulated entities to have favored access to certain enforcement division officials. And that also has hurt the SEC's political strength as an agency. And then we also had, and this is, to me, is the most shocking of all of this litany, we had with the original Paulson plan, before the market crash, Henry Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, had a blueprint for reform of the financial services industry, a great consolidation, which actually called for the eradication of the Securities and Exchange Commission as an independent administrative agency and to be tucked into the Treasury and other parts of the federal bureaucracy. And the idea that this could happen with cadres of SEC alums populating Wall Street, extremely loyal fan club, the SEC Historical Society and other institutions, that this really is a lo how the mighty have fallen story. And I'm not going to say that history will necessarily predict the future in the sense that I'm not sure the SEC is going to come out of the latest round of problems with the same amount of with the same increase in budget and increase in salaries and better jobs, etc. Now, turning now to the core question of the panel, I think it's a great question. Is the SEC to blame for the financial crisis? And what I want to focus on is the fact that in order to be able to blame somebody or something for a bad outcome, then there are a couple of preconditions. One is that entity must have some sort of responsibility for preventing the outcome. And second is that that market participants, people in the public, must have somehow relied on that entity. Did we rely on the SEC to keep us out of trouble? And the critical thing, the most important thing, a point that I want to make today is that no, of course the SEC isn't to blame. To blame the SEC for this financial crisis would give the SEC far too much credit. It would require us to take the SEC far too seriously, far more seriously in a way than it deserves to be taken. Because the SEC and the other panelists have alluded to this, you know, can't really be thought of as, you know, not as, you know, keeping markets healthy. But even you know, the task of regulating debt equity ratios of looking at really responding to sort of the red flags at Bear Stearns that so many people have pointed to is asking quite a bit too much. At best, the SEC is a consumer protection agency. It should protect small investors. It has failed at doing that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they caused this financial crisis. We would not have this financial crisis, however, if the SEC had done its job in the following way. You know, we have in the securities industry, if somebody's buying a share of stock, if we had simply applied, or if the SEC had maneuvered to apply the same protections in the form of the know your customer rule, the suitability rule, the shingle theory, if we've applied these self-same protections, not just to people buying 100 shares of stock in Microsoft, but also to people who are getting subprime mortgages, people in the mortgage markets who are getting these pick-a-pay mortgages and negative amortization mortgages, we wouldn't be in this crisis because we would have people's financing decisions would be much better tailored to their actual economic needs in ways that, that they obviously were not with respect to the, this recent crisis. Finally, I just want to say a word about Enron. We haven't talked about Enron, and I just want to say in my last minute a couple things about it. Number one, most importantly, Enron was a trading firm. If you remember all of our friends on the left, when Enron was in financial distress, they said, how did we allow this venerable utility, steady-state industry company to morph unbeknownst to us into this massive investment bank? Well, what's relevant about that is we had no problems with allowing Enron to fail, unlike the nine financial institutions in which the Treasury's bought preferred stock, and unlike, obviously, Bear Stearns. If we could let Enron fail, which was really functionally in our economy no different than these other firms, then this too-big-to-fail, too-interconnected-to-fail story, I think, loses a lot of its force. The second thing, and I'll stop with this, is if you look at the litany of problems that Enron presented, and you say, this is why we had this massive federal regulation with Sarbanes-Oxley, they were mark-to-market accounting. This was Jeff Skilling's great achievement at the SEC. Valuation of assets rather than discounted cash flows, lack of financial statement transparency, too much leverage, rules versus standards accounting, internal controls, the famous 404 of Sarbanes-Oxley, risk management, problems with credit rating agencies and analysts, that if you go just read your way through the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the public policy problems and the problems of excessive risk-taking that Sarbanes-Oxley, the problem of internal risk management that Sarbanes-Oxley was directed to solve, obviously weren't solved because those are exactly the same problems that we're seeing being blamed for today's crisis. So thank you very much. I look forward to the Q&A. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank each of the panelists and for their very informative remarks. I take it then that we're in general consensus that what we have here is a financial crisis that was largely outside the jurisdiction of the SEC. No one on the panel seems to take very seriously the arguments, for example, that the repeal of the uptick rule is the source of all evil, that mark-to-market accounting explains everything about the demise of Lehman Brothers or what have you. And so perhaps instead of focusing on the, and for the benefit of the audience, we're going to do a few minutes of me queuing and them aing, and then we'll open it to the floor for Q&A. I would like, however, to address with the panel the going forward question for just a minute and tease out a few more thoughts. My good friend Larry Rinstein is a professor at the University of Illinois College of Law, wrote a wonderful little article called Bubble Laws, in which he goes back and he looks at asset bubbles through history, going back as far as the South Sea bubble. And he finds that consistently the bursting of an asset bubble results in what he calls a bubble law. Of course, the very first bubble law having been passed to solve the South Sea bubble crisis. And he remarks, I think quite correctly, that bubble laws have two characteristics. First, they tend to fight the last war. That is to say, they are addressed to the economic problems of the past bubble and therefore do little to anticipate where the next asset bubble will come from or what problems it will create. And secondly, they tend to restrict market flexibility. They tend to discourage entrepreneurship and the like. What will the bubble law of 2009 look like? I think there is almost certain to be a bubble law, and I would be interested to know if any of the panelists disagree with that prediction that there is going to be something that comes out of this. And if so, what might it look like? Now, Mr. Terwilliger gave us a very interesting possibility, which is that of unified financial regulation. And that's really what I'd like the panel to briefly address before we open it to the floor. Mr. Terwilliger, if I could get you to just elaborate on a couple of things. You suggested unified financial regulation. And by that, do you mean how much of the alphabet soup of Washington financial regulation do you anticipate stewing together? We have the SEC and CFTC, and to me, I've never completely understood from a policy perspective why they were separate agencies. And indeed, I will suggest to you that I think a litmus test for how serious the Democrats are about reform is whether or not there is serious consideration being given to merging the SEC and CFTC, because what that would require would be the old bulls in the committee chairmen's, either in ag or financial services, somebody's going to lose control of an agency, right? Do you anticipate the SEC and CFTC merging, or are you also talking about bringing together not only the security side, but also the banking side with Fed and OCC and the FDIC, and having one sort of super economic regulator? And relatedly, do you also anticipate preempting state laws such as the Martin laws, the Blue Sky laws? Do we want to continue to have a situation in which, for example, Elliot Spitzer of Mayflower Hotel fame, or his successor Andrew Cuomo, can basically try to run the national economy using some 19th century New York statute? Could I get you to just elaborate on that briefly?
Sure. I'll be glad to briefly answer a question that would require a couple of hours to really answer substantively, Steve. But
and that's the task of any great litigator such as yourself.
That's right. Which is no doubt why I'm on the panel. I think, realistically, we can only at this point address that in the broadest possible strokes, but you've really outlined it to my mind. I think it requires some pretty careful and studied analysis before we do make major moves like that. And I want to really underscore, if I may, the importance in terms of if this is part of the bubble law that comes out of this one, of really hoping that there is a bipartisan, substantive approach to this, and that politics and gaining some incremental and I think rather temporary political advantage isn't what drives this train, as has so often been the case. It does make sense to me that the regulatory structures and the enforcement structures that govern the financial community, if you will, ought to mirror what actually goes on out there in the real world. And thus, having the agencies that regulate the securities markets, which include the SEC and the CFTC, joined, does make sense to me to put the securities agencies under one umbrella. Likewise, there is at least superficial appeal to having the banking agencies be under one umbrella, although that may require some redefinition to reflect reality of what the FDIC's role is beyond merely being the insurer of bank accounts. The state law question is certainly politically more difficult, but also this circumstance may present an opportune time to address that. And without casting aspersions on any particular individuals you may or may not have mentioned, and I did notice that you left the infamous district attorney from New York County out of your litany. The fact of the matter is that there is rivalry, and including political rivalry often, between some of the state authorities and the federal authorities to be the first to jump on this bandwagon. All that being said, however, I think we all can easily recognize that a lot of the market itself overlaps, particularly since the repeal of Glass-Steagall. Goldman Sachs is now a regulated bank holding company, which is going to fundamentally change the way it's regulated. And I really think we ought to hear not from the people whose ox would currently be gored, but really from the academic community and some people who really understand the practical effects of regulation. Finally, let me, since you tossed this one to me first, try to just reiterate the point I made at the end of my remarks earlier. I think this is a golden opportunity to return the purposes of federal regulation to the core purposes that the federal establishment exists to serve in regard to commerce, and that is by promoting commerce, by protecting the means of instrumentalities of commerce, and protecting the institutions that are necessary to the flow of commerce from fraud, both externally and internally. If we start from the premise that that should be the objective of this whole regulatory environment, I think we will wind up with something much better than we've had to date, and perhaps quite different.
Thank you. Just on the state issue, many of you may know I blog at a website called www.professorbainbridge.com, and one of my earliest blog posts was entitled, "Can You Be a Competitive Federalist and Still Want to Put Elliott Spitzer Out of Business?" And the answer I gave was an affirmative one, and I'll link to it on my blog when I get a chance for those of you that want to go back and see that. Professor Macy, you said we already take the SEC too seriously. Would we take a unified financial agency even more too seriously? Not quite grammatically correct, but...
No, that's a very good and fair question. Just to allow myself to clarify, we can think of the SEC playing, to some extent my analysis would also apply not only to the SEC, but to the credit rating agencies. People say, gosh, the credit rating agencies did a really lousy job in rating all these CDOs, these collateralized debt and mortgage obligations, and so maybe they're to blame for this crisis too. It's a non sequitur. Because if you look at the prices at which these assets traded, the market discounted heavily the high AAA ratings that these securities really got. People didn't take it very seriously. I'm in favor. I completely agree with this idea of consolidating. But why is it that we want to consolidate? The reason we want to consolidate regulation is to make it rational to have similarly situated competitors regulated in comparable ways. But so all the arguments that are made for rationalizing our patchwork quilt of regulation, many of them I find amenable, but it's not going to. It's not addressing the financial crisis. The only way to address the financial crisis is to cause the firms that are and the individuals who are taking big risks and getting big rewards. This is exactly Professor Kitch's point. To internalize the costs associated with taking those risks and getting those rewards, and so we don't do that. We're running away from that. And I don't think moving to a single regulatory agency would do much to correct that problem. In fact, so I don't think it would be – my short answer, Stephen, is no. I don't think it would help.
Professor Kitch, you defended the SEC against accusations that it had been responsible for the financial crisis. Would you defend it from efforts to merge it into a single unified financial regulator?
Well, I'd have to see the proposal. The idea, of course, is modeled on the structure of the English regulation, which has not done any better in this particular crisis. Let me speak up a bit for Chicago. You can argue the CFTC and the statute has played an important role in introducing to world financial markets very important instruments that probably would not have been introduced as quickly if the SEC had exclusive jurisdiction There's been regulatory competition between the New York and the Chicago markets, and the CFTC is a structure that gave the Chicago markets freedom to experiment and innovate. The problem with the unified master regulator, and if you're going to go that way, that it could include banks, query, why shouldn't the financial regulators control the criminal side of the enforcement of their statutes rather than have that go off to the Department of Justice? If you create this super regulator in possession of sort of sitting astride the whole industry, including the banks, which logic would suggest, because they also are techniques of financial intermediation, and you gave it the full range of powers, I think it would lead to a lot of rigidity. The lower offices that would focus on one part of this a huge swath of the economy would, of course, have to get clearance from the up the line from the top person. That would slow things down and could have very bad effects. The discussion, in a way, reminds me of the discussion of the organization of the intelligence agencies and the need for centralization and the creation of the intelligence czar. It's not clear whether that's an improvement or not. Centralization, decentralization has always involves very difficult trade-offs.
Certainly, all the evidence suggests that the creation of the Department of Homeland Security has not been a stunning bureaucratic success, and the idea of replicating that on a part of the economy as important as financial services is certainly questionable. Commissioner Atkins, I don't know if this is a question you care to jump in on, or
no. I think it's clear there will be restructuring. There will be some sort of law that comes about. I agree with George and others about some of the dangers that are coming up. When you look at what the SEC is overseeing now, there are, as George said, there are no more large international investment banks anymore. They're either out of business, or they've been acquired by bank holding companies, or they themselves have become bank holding companies. So with an FSA-type entity in the U.S., would that work? I mean, the blueprint that you alluded to, you know, sets out three different regulators, and the SEC would morph into sort of a cost of a culture of business or type of regulator. But I think that the simple merging of the SEC and the CFTC, you know, might sound appealing, but it has a lot of issues to be resolved. There's culture issues. CFTC regulates mainly on the financial services side, institutional marketplace. SEC is more regulatory, more retail. There are global issues. Some of the problems, like, for example, CDSs, they were mainly booked in London, not in the U.S., because of capital issues here and other compliance issues, so the investment banks did them overseas, so you have an international component here. You look at Lehman Brothers, I think that was, that was, it's too bad, obviously, that it failed. That really was a catalyst for the current problems, I think, for a lot of them. But there was an international component. Most of the problems were that the FSA was not willing yet to step in and guarantee some of the things that were booked in London. So we have other issues that will come up in any sort of rejiggering of the laws, like remember Stone Ridge, that case that the Supreme Court decided just about a year and a half ago. I guarantee that that will be addressed in any new law, and you see the makeup of Congress. And that was with scheme liability, where you, and even if you're not an issuer of securities, you would could have 10b-5 liability with respect to investors in a publicly traded company. So I think ultimately we have to remember what Friedrich Hayek said, that in his book The Fatal Conceit back in 1989, where he said that we cannot shape the world around us as much as we might like to try, and we could do more harm than good if we try.
Thank you. It is fascinating to me that a year ago I was traveling around the country including being here in Washington and talking to Congress, about the need to have regulatory reform of Sarbanes-Oxley, about problems of capital flight, companies going private, the IPO market in the United States shifting abroad, and talking about how to fix Sarbanes-Oxley. The mood is very different today. We are those of us who believe in free markets and free financial markets have gone in very short order from being on the offensive to being on the defensive in an environment that is as hostile to preservation of free markets as I can remember. Well, let's open it to the floor for Q&A. Please identify yourself. State your question as briefly as possible, please avoid speeches. If your question is directed towards a particular panel member, please identify the panelists that you would like to answer your question. We'll start here at the front, go to the back, come back to the front, and so forth. So, sir.
John Rowland, Constitution Society. I'd like the panel to focus more on creative solutions that have not yet been discussed here, because it seems clear that the conventional approach of yet another post-bubble law, new regulatory standards and rules are not going to do the job. Nobody ever got fired, promoted, rich, or popular by pricking bubbles before there was their time to burst. We need to find a way to bring in an intervention that is not bound by rules designed for the last situation. And I'd like you to address the possibility of using the traditional grand jury system as an investigatory arm to simply go in, poke around, with no particular rules in mind, only other than to look for ways things could go wrong and look for ways that creative money managers may be trying to avoid any regulation, any rule, any law that anyone might try to devise, and thereby reducing the overconfidence that tends to result in bubbles developing.
Thank you. Anybody on the panel want to take that?
I guess being somebody who spent a lot of time in grand juries, fortunately as a prosecutor, not as a subject, I'll just take a quick crack at it, and I'll also use that as a segue to react to something that Professor Kitch said in his remarks a few minutes ago. I want to note at the outset that I thought Professor Kitch made a really good point about the existence of the Chicago futures market leading to products that we might not otherwise have. And I took it, if you weren't express about this, that a stifling regulatory bureaucracy may have just proven too much for those things to come into existence. And I think that's a point well taken. Doesn't dissuade me from the need to change the way we're doing things, but I do think it's a good point. I think the last thing we ought to do is encourage more criminal enforcement, whether it's by giving criminal enforcement power to regulatory agencies or, as John just suggested, empowering grand juries to go poke around in the financial market. What we do need, however, is more discretionary enforcement and the power of persuasion to look at larger goals. If any of you have ever dealt with a Federal Reserve inquiry, one of the things you understand is, unlike a lot of regulatory agency inquiries, there are really two sets of rules at work. There are the rules that govern what banks and bank holding companies can and cannot do, and then there's the rules of the club. And it's just as serious to violate the rules of the club as it is to violate the technical terms of the regulation. There is real power and benefit in that.
In the back.
Thank you. Brian Walsh, Heritage Foundation. And first, I'd just like to thank Commissioner Atkins for his leadership on the attorney-client privilege issue. I bring it up partly because the SEC has changed its policy, and it's a good example of how federal government overreacted to some of the problems of the last meltdown. I'm deeply concerned that we're still trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist to some extent. Many people, before I went to law school, I was in the software engineer for a number of years, and there's a saying that says garbage in, garbage out. I think really that's what we're looking at in this instance, and there's been a huge and very successful campaign to message that the underlying asset is not the problem here. But we know that the Cleveland Fed, for example, reported that from 2000 through 2006, the default rate on subprime mortgages was 400 to 600% higher than it was on prime mortgages. And an economist in our shop said last month that the default rate about 60 days ago was about above 50%. So if that's really what we're looking at, we had a meltdown in tech stocks, we had a meltdown in telecom, both of which had something to do with violating the fundamental principles of what an asset should look like and whether it's a sound asset. Here again, we're looking at a robust, unprecedented regulatory scheme for the United States, and yet the messaging on Capitol Hill has been entirely looking at the back end, not looking at the front end, that we had a terrible asset that failed and is continuing to fail at unprecedented numbers. So I'd just like to know what your response is to that, and how do we change that messaging if my analysis is correct.
Well, actually, I'd like to take a crack at that. And it goes back to the question of what can we do positively. I don't expect it to happen given the politics of the situation, but it seems clear to me that one of the things that ought to come out of this episode is a fundamental rethink of housing policy in this country. And in particular, the Bush administration policies of the ownership society. Home ownership peaked under the Bush administration. And it's not entirely clear to me that was a good thing. That there are people who simply were financially, it was too risky for them to get long-term loans, particularly on the terms that were available to them. And this is actually, I think, an interesting opportunity for a conservative liberal coalition to rethink housing policy where, part of the result of the everybody ought to own their own home policy has been the sprawl, the expansion of the exurbs, because everybody wants their own house on a piece of land. And there is an interesting opportunity here for constructive dialogue with the left on how we construct a housing policy that's both financially and economic and environmentally sustainable. But that is way beyond the scope of this panel, and so I think I will call on the gentleman of the
front. Can I just react to one piece of what you said there for a minute? Because I think you and I have both said this is a time of opportunity to address some things that are important. One of the reasons I was particularly honored and gratified to join a panel, I won't put Paul in this category, but of such distinguished academics here, is because I think it's critically important that the people who have the time and the inclination and the ability to sit and actually think about these issues be heard in this, because there are many people in this room and in the Federalist Society who have watched the sausage be made. It is an ugly, unthoughtful process, and these are critical issues to our future. So I really encourage that. I know it is beyond this discussion, but as you say, but it is really important that you and your colleagues be heard on these things.
Well, I blog on it with some regularity up front.
Andy Redleaf, seems to me multiple hedge fund managers published pieces about the condition of financial service firms, including, basically all of them, signed and disclosed that they had an interest. The regulatory sort of response seems to be a great deal of concern about their motives. And whether they might be manipulating markets and not about the substance of their arguments, you know, particularly when they're putting forth that public companies have inaccurate financial statements. Would not a much better regulatory regime that focused on speech and disclosure and actually, you know, encouraged that kind of thing be a better regime? And I can tell you, you know, I mean, the SEC is completely unhelpful on questions of disclosure. If you tell them, here are companies' financial statements, here's, you know, what we think we should know, here's what we think are sort of material questions that are in there, and company won't put out an 8K, you know, would you be helpful? You know, no.
Yeah, well, I mean, I could. A lot of this comes down to the fear of litigation, and until we really have litigation reform in the country, it's going to be a constant problem because people are afraid to speak out and to say things. Then the whole panoply of rules that have to do with, you know, what you can say before, during, or after a public offering. Reg FD and others all impinge on that.
Well, it seems that most of the regulation is directed, or much of the regulation is directed at limiting speech,
control of speech,
and control of speech, as opposed to, you know, sort of disclosure of your interest and substance of argument. As long as you disclose sort of your interest and it's signed, you know, should not the SEC be encouraging speech and be encouraging disclosure? And so forth. Instead of, you know, being concerned that they're nefarious,
a departure from that norm is, I think, if you look at the after the whole Enron and WorldCom and the research analysts, some of the practices that came out, you know, the regulations that the SEC put out to require analysts to disclose their holdings and that sort of thing.
There is, I tell my class in securities regulation, the little-known codicil to the First Amendment, which says the SEC can do whatever it wants. John, Ed, would either of you like to address the question?
I completely agree. Stephen, other than say it's probably not little-known codicil, but it's certainly codicil.
All right. In the back?
Mike Francella, Morrison & Forrester. I was at a conference about a month ago where there was a panel that discussed likely regulatory changes coming out of this, and the predominant view there seemed to be that it was more likely than not that we would move either to an FSA-style single regulator or to, I think, what was referred to as a Twin Peaks regulator on the Australian model, I think it was, that where you have one agency dealing with consumer protection issues and the second dealing with sort of standards, practices, the way that the firms themselves operate. And I'm hearing more skepticism on this panel about that kind of fundamental change. So I guess I was wondering if any of the panelists would care to put on their profits hats and have any ideas about the relative likelihood of moving to one of those or the other versus staying as we are with little or no significant change, perhaps just a merger of the SEC, CFTC, something like that.
Stephen, I'd like to just very quickly, I want to go back to something Stephen said a while ago, which was when you're looking at one of the things you have to focus on when you're trying to predict what consolidation will look like is look at the committee structure in Congress, look at kind of who's gaining power, who's losing power, and one of the big problems with consolidation is that people are going to have to give up chairmanships and oversight and budgetary controls. So one thing that I think is useful to do is to think of where can we have regulatory reform which will result in a net increase in power for Congress. And the obvious answer to that, of course, is preemption of state law. So the idea that, you know, it's kind of an amazing thing to step back and think about it, that, you know, the one exception to the systematic nationalization of law has been U.S. corporate law, which until Sarbanes-Oxley remained vastly in the province of the states, and we have a robust jurisdictional competition for corporate chartering. My guess is that we're going to see more of what we got with Sarbanes-Oxley in terms of incursions on state corporate law, which will move power to Washington without hurting anyone's sort of committee positions. And I think, you know, I think that Paul Atkins is absolutely right with respect to, you know, Denver Bank and Stone Ridge, that, you know, this is going to be open buffet for the plaintiff's class action lawyers.
We'll take one last question up here up front, and then we have to break.
Thanks. My name is Bonnie Wachtel. In my day job, I run a securities brokerage firm. Question for Commissioner Atkins. In the course of my career, I remember after the crash of 1987 and I believe after the events of 2001, the SEC took some immediate steps. In particular, in 2001, they suspended the normal regulations under which corporations could repurchase their own stock. So there was just immediate counter-cyclical action, which I thought was very impressive. In this case, you have the SEC has its finger directly on the pulse of three intensely pro-cyclical elements of the problem, one being naked short selling, which is a rule that is still not being fully enforced. The second is mark-to-market accounting, and let me say in deference to my brother Redleaf, I have no objection to having it in a footnote for information purposes, but it's there currently for regulatory purposes, other than whatever has been cooked up in the last week or so. And the third is the monopoly of the rating agencies, which the market may not give a damn about them, but they're written into debt covenants and insurance contracts, which is the problem. Now, what I would have hoped that the SEC would do, I'm a big believer in counter-cyclical action as part of what a regulator can do, and even if you can't pinpoint bubbles and crashes, you can measure them by standard deviation or in some independent, unbiased way and be counter-cyclical in your regulations. I would expect the SEC to have had some crisis management team here to act very quickly to be moving in that direction, to be changing things, boom, because they see some magnitude of the problem led by the Fed. And I'm just wondering, is that happening and I'm not seeing it? Can that happen? Any hope for that? That's just under the current structure. You don't have to put everything together or even preempt the states.
And Paul, I need you to answer that in crisis management speed mode.
In 2 seconds, yeah. Well, I there's a huge amount, obviously, to talk about on that. I have a lot of confidence in some of the folks there at the SEC, and they, you know, for example, they did do a they similar to after 9/11, whatnot. They did allow corporations to buy back stock here during their recent crisis back in September. I think they had a rule that came out to allow that. Then, with respect to naked shorting, you know, that's a huge issue, and I agree with you. I think there were some steps that I thought they were going to take immediately when I left the commission. Unfortunately, they didn't get done. But, for example, I think to actually have a penalty to if you borrow and then you know, the stock and you don't want to pay for it and you sort of kick the can down the road, that sort of thing, which is allowed to go on, is a problem, and I think that fosters some of the issues. But some of the ad hocery, for example, outlawing shorting completely in the marketplace created a lot of the panic there in September, caused a lot of problems for hedge funds, and you know, exacerbated the volatility in the marketplace. So it's a huge issue. We'd have to treat it some other time, but I agree with your sentiments.
Thank you all very much. I would first like us to single out for special thanks Commissioner Paul Atkins, not only for his excellent participation in this forum today, but also as an opportunity. As John Macy said, he has been an exceptional SEC commissioner and a powerful voice for free markets and competitive markets and American competitiveness during his time in the commission. And I'd like us to single him out for special thanks.
Thank you.